very excited to have Sandra here. She has been a member of the Finish Line Writers Group, which meets here at the Writer Center, for some time now, and has become an integral part of our community here. Becoming part of the board and attending the open mics also, and just being a really great person. And her novella, Moss on Stone, which was based on the life of a young woman in Rockport, was really great to listen to and to read. And we're looking forward to hearing Time and Tide, which is your collection of stories. And I think I'll let you, go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you everyone for coming tonight. I'm happy to see some new faces and some old friends and some people from our Finish Line Writers Group who helped with this book. I self-published this Moss on Stone book about 2 years ago, I think, now. And I wasn't planning on writing anything else to publish. But before this was finished, I had already written all the stories that are in here, and I think I brought them all to the Finish Line Writers Group. So they really helped me to polish it up and to save me from myself when I did things that could be deleted. So when I thought of making a collection, I call it a collection of tales because they have sort of a twist to each one, a little bit of, I wouldn't call it magical realism, but it's a little bit, some odd things happen. I call it the human alchemy, you know, of experience that sometimes ends in golden revelations. It speaks of change, inevitable change. And when I thought to publish them, I thought, well, I'd like to have something that would tie them together, like a framing device, like Chaucer used, or Boccaccio, or Sherwood Anderson in Winesburg, Ohio. Of course, not with their fame and fortune or literary status, but my husband and I were in a clock shop in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We brought a clock to be fixed. And when we walked in, it was just rows and rows, shelves of old antique clocks, beautiful clocks. And when they chimed, it was just incredible. It was sort of magical. And Bob said, well, I wonder, you know, who owned these clocks? And they could probably tell you some stories. So I got that in my mind that that could be the framing device, that a woman comes back from Italy. She's a writer. She doesn't think she has anything to write about anymore, and I know what that feels like. But she comes home to take care of her mother, who's dying. Her mother dies, and then she reads, before her mother dies, she reads a book of hours every day and night. And then she goes back, she goes to the clock shop, and she finds a clock there, and she brings it home. And the man there tells her, if you bring the clocks home and you love them, they'll tell you their story. And she said, this is crazy. But she didn't forget it. So she went back. And the first story in this book is called The Book of Hours. It's where the reader hears of the origin of the tales. So I just wanted to read the first paragraph there and what happens with the clock. Book of Hours. The sign caught her eye. It was round and gleaming, reflecting the afternoon sun. Time and Tide antique clocks, printed in black letters on a white clock face with Roman numerals. She noticed there were no hands on the clock. Although the shop had been on the outskirts of town forever, she had never taken notice of it as she did on this day. She had driven 2 hours since leaving the airport and was ready for the day to end, but felt compelled to turn in at the entrance next to the sign. And that's where she finds the clock and then goes back after her mother dies. And she brings it back to her mother's house. She doesn't know if she'll go back to Italy or not. But I'll just read the very end where she gets inspired to write the tales. The clock was beautiful, glowing above the blazing fireplace in the little room. She ran her fingers over the case, tracing the gold lines on the glass. She spent days in reverie there. What to do? Where to go? Back or forward? She didn't know, but for now she would simply live in the silent company of the clock. On the threshold of spring, she awoke as if she were preparing to sail out on a faraway adventure. She picked up the key, wound the clock, and set the pendulum into motion. In the following days, when the clock chimed, she would read the designated prayers at the hours of daylight and often during the hours of night. As the chime sounded, she sometimes felt herself drift into another realm of no place and no time. At peace, she existed until all manner of dark and light beings began to flash and flutter before her, some in images like holographs, others heard in voices, heard in whispers, and secret thoughts. When they came like a swift incoming tide, surreal, filled with beauty and sadness, old regrets and new life, muddled and intertwined as in a dream. There was the image of a man come back to his childhood home to tell of his wanderings to an empty room, and the voice of a woman obsessed with the starry sky, then brought back to earth through the suffering of others. She thought the thoughts of a therapist whose saintly lover gave her a gift, and of a husband left alone to endure memories of all that was lost to him. She saw the shadow of an enlightened soul becoming a truer form of herself. She heard a mother's grieving for her lost son on sacred ground. She felt the confusion of a young actress who was deceived by desire for what she thought was love. There was a vision of a teacher whose broken, irreparable things became her strength. So this woman returns to Italy and she writes her stories one by one, her tales. And the tales are The Holes They Leave, True Minds, Cruel Sunset, Shiva's Table, A Matter of Time, God is Love, On This Ground, and Broken Beads, Blue Sky. So I thought I would just read a paragraph from a few of the stories, and then I'd like to read one whole story, the first one that I ever wrote. I'll tell you something about that then. So this one's The Holes They Leave. Can you hear me okay? Okay. That night, the stars kept me awake. I couldn't sleep, so I went to the window overlooking the ocean. A green light flashed at the horizon beyond the cloaked meadow. Looking up, I saw more stars than I ever remembered, brilliant and gleaming. Elated, I felt my whole being inhaling the ebony sky teeming with star life. I stood in awe for moments, minutes, or hours. How long, I couldn't tell. And she gets obsessed with the starry sky, and she wants to get that feeling back that she had that night, and she can't, no matter what. So she says, I also began to look for anything written about the stars, trying to find some articulation of my own experience. I found many expressions influenced by stars and written about the starry sky, but the lines in this poem came closest to my experience. And now each night I count the stars, and each night I get the same number. And when they will not come to be counted, I count the holes they leave. And I got permission from the estate of Amiri Baraka to use those lines in this poem in this story, because it just fits so well. And True Minds, just the first paragraph. He pressed his forehead against the cold window pane until it fogged over. The front and back doors were locked, and his keys didn't open them. He went around to the side of the cottage, separated the thick growth of vines, and peered in the bedroom window. Nothing remained of what had been in place when he left that morning. He felt himself telescoping to a distance above, as if looking down on the scene. He watched himself walk around the front, where he found the sign, "For Sale," next to the bare willow tree. He headed for the pub in town. And this is from A Matter of Time. He had given away every last penny of an enormous inheritance. He was homeless, but it didn't matter. He missed being able to help others. I found this out when a stranger called me and told me Kenny had given him $1,500 to see me for as many therapy sessions as that amount would cover. Inheriting a fortune is everyone's ultimate fantasy, but Kenny just handed his out like cupcakes at a birthday party. So this therapist and Kenny were lovers, and they parted because they were destined to part. And and then she receives a gift from him. But I just wanted to read a little bit about their relationship. Who cared if the attraction was hormones or pheromones and not destiny? There must have been a genetic code for a disaster in the nature of our relationship. We were too different, and he gradually ascended or descended, depending on the way you looked at it, into an unreachable place, intent, it seemed, on becoming a saint himself. It wasn't going to work. His mind was like a black hole, sucking everything into it. Nothing escaped. Ideas, facts, probabilities, and possibilities. Mine was more like a sieve, holding only what I needed to get through each day. The rest sifted through. Anyway, it's how I came to think of us as opposites. And this one is from God is Love, mm-hmm. A man who comes back to his childhood home for atonement, but nobody's there, and he speaks to the empty room and imagines his family's there. But driving for hours, he started to imagine that the road stretching straight ahead was endless, his anxiety building, like when he first tried to grasp the idea of forever, or envision the universe expanding outward into what, into where. Colors and shapes blurred and faded together, tree branches into sky, gravel edging the road into fields of dried corn stalks. Wispy clouds lined the glowing horizon at sunset as he traveled west. This was how he remembered it in the cold season. He was going back after so many years. He didn't know what he would find, but he would close the circle of life, whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere. And on this ground, this idea I got from coming here to a lecture or talk by Marianne LaBianca one night. Remember, you talked about Native Americans on Cape Ann. And toward the end of the talk, this woman stood up right over there and she said that her son had been killed in an accident near Whale Cove, and that when she found out that Indians had danced on that spot, it somehow comforted her. And I just didn't forget it, and I made up a story about it, but it's based on that idea. It comforted Nora to think that on the ground where he took his last breath, Indians had once danced. She didn't find this out until later, wondering all through summer and fall if she had somehow imagined it. Since that rainy evening, she slept on the sofa in the front room. She kept the shades up, waiting to see him coming up the walkway or to hear him open the door. When she arrived at the accident scene that night, she saw the chalked outline of her son's body. Only an hour before, she had been called to the hospital. His young face was at peace. She was given a blue plastic bag with his white sweatshirt, keys, cigarette lighter, wallet, iPod, some coins, and an arrowhead he had always carried with him. She reached for the sweatshirt, held it to her face, inhaled the scent of him, and pulled it over her head. She walked a few steps to the chalked outline and lay down within it on the wet, leaf-strewn sidewalk. So she finally gets up and decides to go to the scene of the accident again after many, many months. And by the time she reached the place she had dreaded but longed to be, a perfect, almost invisible imagination had been formed, perfect in that it was whole, woven in reverse from moments in time, expanding outward to encompass the lives of mother and son and family, then, now, and forever. Looking up, she saw a signpost rising from the pavement, one of those placards noting some bit of history. Why haven't I seen this before? Was it always here? It said, Samuel de Champlain, due east from here on July 16th, 1605, the Sierra de Mont sent Samuel de Champlain ashore to parley with some Indians. They danced for him and traced an outline map of Massachusetts Bay. Nora remained some time looking up at the sign. She reached down to touch the ground. Something extraordinary had taken place here long ago, an exchange, a sharing, a trust, a true meeting among strangers. Those who had arrived on a foreign shore and the souls they encountered who danced to welcome them and who shared their knowledge of the land, a living knowledge inside of them. And it was here, too, where another soul had departed, Andrew, whom she had both striven to know and to become more like. Has he united with the others from another time? In an instant, she became the bare trees and the gray sky, the falling snow, a small but integral part within creation which holds all that was, is, and will be. Time, she smiled and shook her head. Another illusion. We are all here, then and now and tomorrow. How long she remained at this in this reverie of her own creation, in the light of the knowledge the placard had shed, who knows? She turned, glanced back once. A few snowflakes floated down like feathers. Feeling the cold more than before, even though the wind had subsided, she began walking quickly downhill. And then I'd like to read a whole story. I hope it's not too long. I don't think it's too long, but this is called Broken Beads, Blue Sky. And this is based on the life of my friend Marianne Wells, who was a teacher with me at the Waldorf School in Lexington. It's not all true, but some things are. Bob and I had gone to a play at the Waldorf School in Belmont to see the importance of being earnest. And after the show, one of the girls pulled off her necklace, which was Marianne's mother's. She would bring props and different things for the students, and this girl just pulled the beads off and they broke all over and went in the back of the stage. But Marianne picked them all up and tried to put them together and make them whole again. Not too long after that, she was diagnosed with fourth stage cancer and she died last year. So I dedicated the book to her. It's called Broken Beads, Blue Sky. The beads had broken and scattered over the backstage floor. They had been her mother's. Four strands, a tiny crystal between each rose-colored iridescent bead and a gold filigree clasp. She remembered gazing at them, touching them, rolling them in her small fingers as she sat on her mother's lap. That was so many years ago. When she was 21, her mother had warned, "Don't marry that man," but she did. On her wedding day, only a few months after her mother had died from an aggressive cancer, she had begged her father, "Don't let that woman sit next to you where Mom was supposed to be," but he did. On her honeymoon, under a clear blue sky on an island beach, she sat on her tie-dyed scarf, the sun beating down with a cool breeze off the surf as the tide came in. She called to her husband as he walked along the waves, "Don't be long," but he was. She waited alone until the sun was going down, the wind chilling her to the bone. The once clear blue sky seemed to resemble her transparent scarf, now wrapped around her shoulders, fading blue, streaked with gray and yellow, which made her cry. Since then, he had been disappearing, leaving her to wonder and worry, where does he go? How long will he be gone? Does he ever realize he's missed, or even that he's expected back at all? Doesn't he remember that he intended to finish fixing that door, that he was supposed to meet me for lunch, that he will miss dinner with the family again? Whenever she tried to figure out the how and why of it, her thoughts raced to a vanishing point. She told herself it didn't matter after all. What worried her most was her husband's patience showing up when he might not be there to receive them. One day, the few remaining appointments were canceled, and he retired from a dwindling career. Later, they learned there was good reason for his seemingly inconsiderate antics. Finding the reason didn't change things much, even with medication and therapy. It could not be fixed. She would have to adjust to the new reality and struggle to transform her denial into acceptance, her impatience into tolerance, and her resentment into understanding. The contraries. These were the thoughts that arose in her as she looked for and collected the scattered beads. She had brought some of her mother's jewelry for the high school girls to wear in their roles as aristocratic Victorian ladies. One of the careless girls tugged at those strands of memory, sending the beads into the shadows behind the stage curtains. Christina would take the beads to a shop for repair, and they would be back on all four strands like new. What was wrong with that girl, anyway? Christina liked finding use for the things she had salvaged from her childhood home in a forlorn upstate New York town. Besides the jewelry, she had a yellow bakelite clock in the shape of a teapot hanging above her stove. There were six ruby-red wine glasses, a set of dishes trimmed with dogwood flowers, hand-painted bowls arranged in the glass front cabinet as her mother had kept them. Most cherished were old letters and cards found in her mother's desk after the funeral. touchable memories to take into her hands and hold to her heart for comfort when she could not manage to be accepting, tolerant, or understanding. Driving home this night, she kept thinking, things are breaking, coming apart, irreparable. That very morning, as she dressed for the long day, she had brushed against and dislodged the small plate hanging on the wall, the one her mother had given her before entering the hospital for the last time. On the sky blue and white memento, written in silvery script, was Baby Christina Marie, born November 10th, 1974, 7 pounds, 3 ounces. She left it shattered on the floor. Almost home now, she loosened her fingers on the wheel as she drove down the tree-lined street. She recalled the sense of freedom she had once felt driving east on the Mass Pike to her uncharted life, to all that was still ahead of her, singing out, Boston, you're my home. Later, she found she had to get away from her new home when once too often her husband didn't show up for dinner. She had to make excuses to angry patients. He had forgotten to call for heating oil, and she came home to a frigid house. Then there were those maddening one-sided conversations, constant interruptions with unrelated questions and non sequiturs until she had to laugh or go insane. Who am I living with anyway, Salvador Dali? She usually laughed, but when she couldn't, it was time to flee. She would pack up the car and head west with her two small children to visit her father, but that also meant seeing the woman he married, the one who had seen fit, without consideration, to take her rightful place as the new wife next to Christina's father in the church pew, the one who ever after resented the futile request of a motherless bride. Once during one of those spontaneous trips, that woman called Christina selfish and disrespectful when she had said, I'd like to feed the kids before Dad gets home. They usually are in bed by 8, and it's been a long day with the drive and all. Well, your father won't be here till 8:30, so they'll have to wait. It won't kill them to not get their way for once. Christina had laid a crisp white cloth, as her mother had always done, and had begun to set the table with her mother's dishes, found pushed to the back of the kitchen cabinet. The plates were pure white with a border of green ivy. I don't think he would mind if the children ate early, Charlotte, she tried to reason, and called the children to the table. But before her words were out, there was a sharp sting of Charlotte's hand across her cheek. You never did have an ounce of respect. Well, you don't get your way around here anymore. Christina dropped the plate she was holding, put her hand up to her face, and blinked back the hot tears, welling up so the children wouldn't see, but they heard Charlotte's harsh words. They saw the broken plate and their mother's leaning over to pick up the pieces. Charlotte grabbed the plates already on the table and the shards from Christina's trembling hands and tossed them into the trash can. There, I've been meaning to throw those old things away. She removed a set of drab brown dishes from the cabinet and held them out to Christina. She pointed to the mismatched glasses on the shelf, a Coke glass, one with Peter Pan and the darling children flying away, and the three others with painted with watermelon slices. Now finish the job and we'll wait for your father to come home. Christina mechanically went around the table with the dishes and glasses, taking solace in thoughts of her mother's thin-stemmed ruby glasses in her own cabinet at home. Can people just be replaced like broken china? In the quiet of night, she returned to the kitchen, took the plates out of the trash, and put them in her suitcase, intending to mend the broken ones when she got home. She loved her father deeply, despite his betrayal and or hasty marriage, where the funeral baked meats did coldly furnish up the marriage table, lines she had quoted from Hamlet to her husband on the day of what she called the unholy union. Thoughts of that incident lingered as she parked the car. She shuddered at the memory of it, but hurtful as it was, she also remembered that when her father arrived home that evening, he smiled, hugged her, and said he was glad she had come home. It never felt like home again without her mother. Home. Is it a place or a feeling? She was glad the day was at an end and there was a parking place to be had. Gathering up the bags in the back seat, she heard the rustle of leaves from the chestnut tree at the curb's edge, a welcome in the balmy night air. She stopped and looked up at the front steps with a sigh, worn out and on edge. At least a small weight had lifted from her director duties over the year. She climbed the steps to the front door and up the staircase to the second floor landing, where she faced two rooms. One was open to the shadowy office where streetlights cast dark reflections. Branches and leaves danced on the ceiling and walls like a crazy light show in an abandoned room. She pushed open the other door to the living room with her foot and dropped the plastic bags containing a plaid smoking jacket, a blue chiffon dress, a silver cigarette case, a blonde wig, a wooden jewelry box, and a pink satin bag containing the broken beads. She had intended to go straight to bed, but the sofa looked inviting. Besides, she was too tired to walk the extra few feet to the bedroom. She flopped down, grabbed the remote, and found a favorite old movie. Staring at the TV screen, her mind drifted to a meeting with her best friend a week ago, the worst day of her life. As they walked along the shore, Christina told her friend about the dreaded doctor's appointment that day. There was a long silence. Then her friend said, "If we could see things from the highest perspective, it would all be good." It was thoughtless and rude of her to say that. Hadn't she just heard the bad news? For many years, the women had confided in each other, discussed everything from babies to books. They had pondered whether life had any meaning, and if so, what it could be. They would look at each other and say, "It is what it is, it will be what it will be." But now it was different. Christina knew what was to be. Together they had read about karma, considered it a more rational alternative to heaven, hell, or nothingness. They neither entirely believed nor disbelieved that souls chose the circumstances of their existence before birth, ones that would provide the context to live out their karma. They agreed everyone's life seemed to have a theme and pattern, with recurring questions and challenges to guide them, maybe even a destiny. But also there were choices to be made in life, informed by increasing consciousness and self-knowledge. Still, Christina thought for her friend to have suggested anything could be good about the diagnosis was wrong. Is this my destiny? Did I choose it? Can I change it? Fix it? Get well? Is the highest perspective heaven? And why do I have to sink so low to get there? As thoughts crowded in, she looked around at the cluttered room. She didn't know what to believe. Her husband shuffled in and stood in front of her. She was surprised to see he was still awake. Usually he would be on the sofa, asleep, or already in bed. After 20 years of marriage, there was no predicting what she could count on him for, yet he loved her and she loved him. That was never in question. He was not unfaithful, he was not unkind, and he always wandered back home to her. It had just taken those years of adjusting and lowering expectations to realize that she could depend on him only for the things he was able to do and not for those she wished for or needed. Is it part of my karma or his? Her mind fogged over with the mystery of it all. She was happy to see him and grateful for those things he could manage. How'd it go? Oh, the kids did a great job. We packed the house and they loved it, but I'm glad it's over. Though she was still upset about the broken bead, she didn't have the energy to tell him about that. Want something to drink? There's some leftover pizza. No, I'm fine. Hey, are you coming with me tomorrow? What time? My appointment's at 2. I'll be home around 1. I'll go with you, he said, padding back into the kitchen, then came back with a glass of cranberry juice and a cold piece of pizza. I don't think I can eat. I'm going back to bed, he interrupted and walked away. Okay, I'll be there in a few minutes, she called back, wondering whether he would be around the next day or go AWOL, as the family came to refer to his absences. She leaned back against the soft cushions and closed her eyes, listening to the familiar banter between Tracy and Hepburn. When she opened them again, she saw the end in big white letters on a grainy black screen. She roused herself, and though exhausted, she dreaded another sleepless night. She sat up staring at the bags on the floor, thinking again about high perspectives, low places, broken beads and dishes, karma and cancer treatments. She felt she didn't have the strength to undress, but picked up the nightgown she had thrown at the foot of the bed that morning. She saw the shattered pieces of the plate on the floor and turned away. She eased into bed, edging back toward her husband until her legs touched his, as was her habit. Tomorrow is another day, but not an ordinary one. Images of her children's faces appeared. It had been the hardest thing telling her family, their sadness and apprehension of grief. There was a long silence. Her daughter was in tears, and her son said, "I want you to get well." Her husband put his head down. The oncologist had told her she would not get well and would be in some kind of treatment for the remainder of time she had left. Since then, the family talk was only of practical matters, treatments, appointments, and the details of getting things in order. She shielded her son and daughter from most of it, taking on the burden of their pain as well as her own. Still, she had hope. She had the will to live, if not the strength to think about whatever she had to endure ahead. She wasn't sure how miracles fit into her life's theme, her free will or destiny, but she believed in prayer and in miracles. It was another uncharted place, being caught between hope and despair. Out of everyone I've ever known, her friend had said, you're the bravest, strongest, and most positive person. Funny, though, she didn't feel strong, positive, or even like a person, but rather like a shadow of the self she had tried to build and sustain in this lifetime. She felt parts of her were missing, wavering like the quivering branches on the ceiling of the abandoned room at the top of the stairs, a shadow of something real, but not real. You love life and live life, her friend had said, as if Christina needed a reminder, especially now. She also was left to hold on to the other thing her friend said. It's not over till it's over. She closed her eyes, listening to her husband's quiet breathing as these thoughts, feelings, and images swirled together, faded into the dark future, and then into sleep. In the hospital waiting area the next day, she gazed out the window at the vast, clear, blue, cloudless sky. Christina, the nurse called, and came over to stand in front of her, blocking out the blue. We're ready for you. Come on back. She got up, looked at her husband, lost child, not even pretending to be strong for her. He smiled and lifted his hand. She carried his smile with her down the long corridor and into the sterile room. The nurse got her settled on a bed, turned up to the sitting position, and prepared an IV drip of a bright red liquid. Christina was grateful to be opposite a window with a view of blue sky. In the closed palm of her hand, she held one of the rose-colored beads. She loved the feel of its smoothness. It had nothing to do with the rest of the beads now. It was beautiful and perfect all on its own. She closed her eyes and imagined being bathed in the glow of its color and felt herself to be looking down from a very high place, a place where she could see everything exactly as it was. The end. Thank you. Pardon? So I think the theme I sort of found, I didn't know they were connected, the stories were connected when I started to put them together, but I guess everything comes out of the writer, and a lot of the things in there will have to do with false expectations and illusions about life and how sometimes we get jolted out of it, maybe not totally, but you know, nothing's ever totally resolved, but also there are some little magical things that happen and things we don't expect. So well, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it.